Last week, we saw four nations join together, attack, invade, and occupy five other nations for a total of 12 years. After 12 years of brutal oppression, the five occupied nations rose up and fought back. Reading now from Genesis 14, 10 through 12. Now the valley of Siddim was full of bitumen. And as the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, some fell into them, and the rest fled into the hill country. So the enemy took all the possessions of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their possessions and went their way. They also took Lot, the son of Abram's brother, who was dwelling in Sodom, and his possessions, and went their way. Here we have Abraham's nephew Lot popping up again. Well, Lot and his family get stuck in the middle of a war because they're not living where they're supposed to be, and they get taken captive. The next verse. Then one who had escaped came and told Abram, the Hebrew, who was living by the oaks of Mamre, the Ammonite, the brother of Eshcol and of Aner. These were allies of Abram. The first time the word Hebrew in the Bible is showing up now. The word means outsider or stranger. Abraham is the oddball. He's the weirdo. So Abraham being called the Hebrew here isn't necessarily a compliment. Verses 14 through 16. When Abram heard that his kinsmen had been taken captive, he led forth his trained men born in his house, 318 of them, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. So Abram gets wind of what happens and says, "Oh, no, you didn't." And he divided his forces against them by night, and he and his servants, and defeated them and pursued them to Hoboth, north of Damascus. Then he brought back all the possessions and also brought back his kinsman Lot with his possessions and the women and the people. Lot is like a piece of bubblegum on a hot day stuck to Abraham's shoe. He's always got a problem that he cannot solve by himself. Lot makes bad decisions. Abraham cleans up the mess. Lot moves his family to Sodom, gets taken captive in a war, and now Abraham has to saddle up and go get him. Abraham had 318 trained assassins, meaning he's got his own army. He's a military strategist. He brings together the five kings from the oppressed nations and leads them to fight for and win their freedom. Now, Abraham at this point is 75 years old, so he's going to ride over 100 miles just to get to the battle. Well, I'm 10 and a half years younger than him, and I have to be wrapped in duct tape and tied to the seat of a car to ride 100 miles in the car, let alone ride a horse or a donkey for 100 miles into battle. After Abraham travels 100 miles, he pushes the invading occupied forces 100 miles further. Do you know how strong you have to be to fight for 100 miles? Have you ever been in a physical fight before? Now, my brothers and I, we didn't argue. I mean, we did argue, but it always ended up in physical fighting. We would tackle, pin down, push, hit, and chase. And after about 10 minutes of that, we were done in, which is a good thing, or we probably would have killed each other. What I'm trying to say is fighting like that is hard work. Abraham and company are fighting with swords and fists. This is what Abraham and his army did for 100 miles. Abraham pushes the enemy 100 miles into the tar pits. Then he encircles them so they only have two choices now. They're either going to die by the sword or they're going to jump into the tar pits. Abraham is not a pacifist. He's a pass the fist. Abraham knows this is not the time for pacifism because evil will never, ever stop itself. Evil has to be stopped. Genesis 14 is a case study of evil being stopped and setting captives free. It is noble to stop evil and set captives free. But people prefer pacifism. The problem is we're passive to the point of letting evil do just what it wants to. There is a time for pacifism, but not when evil is sticking its tongue out at you. Evil said, "Nana, nana, boo-boo, you can't get me," to Abraham, and Abraham said, "Oh yeah, watch this." The truth is, people will not put up with bugs, but they will put up with evil. If I were to ask you this morning to take a solemn vow not to eat bugs for an entire year, I'll bet you all would take that vow. Well, I'm going to reveal something this morning, and you're going to think I'm gross, but I have eaten bugs before. I have eaten cicadas and crickets and an occasional chocolate-covered ant. Now, I do not blame you for looking at me like I have two heads, but I will venture to say that if I did something bad, you would forgive me quicker for doing the bad thing than you will for me having eaten bugs. People condemn me for eating bugs, but they will make all kinds of excuses for me for the wrongs I've committed. Well, she did it because she had a hard childhood. Well, you know, she hasn't been sleeping well at night. Or, you know, she's getting old and cranky. Why people would find me more disgusting if I ate bugs than if I'd done evil? And the answer is this: because we don't hate evil as much as we hate bugs. We are living in a country where more and more evil is being excused and accepted. It is having a terrible effect on our society. Never a day goes by where I don't see some kind of an article about an innocent person, and a lot of them are kids, being killed, raped, maimed, or molested by someone who was not punished for their previous evil acts. Last winter, two innocent young women were attacked on public transit systems, which would have never happened if the legal system was punishing evil. I'm going to tell you their stories, but I'm not going to mention the criminals' names, because in my opinion, they don't deserve to have their names mentioned. Bethany McGee was 26, and she was severely burned on her face and body when she was doused with gasoline and set on fire at Chicago's L in what authorities have called a barbaric and premeditated attack. This guy was a repeat felon. He had 72 arrests on his rap sheet, including aggravated arson, multiple felony battery convictions. Then the judge let this attacker back out on the streets in August with an ankle monitor. But before she let him go, she said, "Now, can I trust you not to violate this ankle monitor? Can I trust you to abide by the rules I'm giving you today?" Of course, the guy says yes, but he didn't. Not long after he was set free by the judge, he set this poor girl on fire. On another public transit in Charlotte, North Carolina, a violent repeat felon slashed the throat of Irina Zariska, a 23-year-old Ukrainian refugee, and as she was on her way home from her job. Her attacker was also a career criminal with a long rap sheet, including assault and armed robbery. But he was treated with kids' gloves by the legal system. And this legal system is not interested in serving justice to people bearing certain skin tones, thinking that it makes up for past injustices. The problem with this kind of thinking is this: people with those skin tones are more often than not the victim of these crimes. People with brown and black skin tones are often the victims of crimes by professional criminals who've been let loose by the justice system. Case in point, Houston, Texas media reports that judges are freeing repeat violent offenders from jail. In a short span of time, this practice has left 130 Texans dead, most of whom were black. And this is the very population that the justice system says that they're trying to protect. The Old Testament prophet Amos was not a professional prophet. He was a farmer and a shepherd. Amos, the unprophet, spoke out against the evil in ancient Israel. In Amos 2, Amos accuses the people of relabeling sin. We've seen this very thing happen in our country. Give the sin a different name, and presto chango, it's not a sin anymore. Well, God was outraged by this practice. Amos called the people to reform their corrupt society to one of justice and morality. Amos 5, 14 and 15. Seek good, not evil, that you may live. Then the Lord God Almighty will be with you, just as you say he is. Hate evil, love good, maintain justice in the courts. What was that? Maintain justice in the courts. Then perhaps the Lord God Almighty will have mercy on the remnant of Joseph. Amos here is using active verbs. The people are to be actively aware of the wickedness in their society, to actively care about it. They are to actively hate evil and love what is good. Amos's call to hate evil and love good is a clarion call which echoes throughout the scriptures. Isaiah 5:20, woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. When any society begins to call evil good and good evil, it is in danger of becoming extinct. We see it in the world of science, in arts and entertainment, in our homes, and even in religion. A complete inversion has happened in our society. Ideology trumps facts. Lies are accepted as truths. Emotion rules over logic, and politics is God. In big and small ways, our world has turned upside down, and frankly, I don't think this is going to end well. There is a total unwillingness to call evil for what it is. We have learned to conceal evil with euphemisms. We no longer lie, we misspeak. We no longer sin, we make mistakes. We no longer murder, we snap. We no longer commit adultery, we have lapses in judgment. We no longer have prostitutes, we have sex workers. We no longer have modern forms of slavery, we have human trafficking. We no longer go to porno movies, we go to movies that have adult content. There are no longer pedophiles, there are minor attracted persons. You see that? Relabeling the thing makes it sound not quite as bad, does it? See, the euphemism isn't the problem. Sometimes euphemisms are preferred. Instead of telling the whole room what we are literally going to do, we simply say, well, I'm going to go to the ladies' room. No, the euphemism isn't the problem. The problem is the evil that the euphemism is trying to cover up. A devaluation of evil has bled even into our university classrooms. One university history professor admitted that he was teaching his students about the Holocaust. And you know, there's a big debate now whether or not the Holocaust actually happened. But this guy told his students, yes, the Holocaust actually happened, but we cannot judge anyone who participated. The values of good and evil are changing places. Woe to us when we call good evil and evil good. Any honest evaluation of evil is considered out of touch. Yet God insists that we evaluate good and evil and attach values to them. Romans 12:9, love must be sincere. Hate what is evil. Cling to what is good. Good and evil do have values. Good has been defined by what I love, and evil is defined by what I hate. But evil can't be defined by what I hate. Evil means profoundly immoral or malevolent, wicked, depraved. Well, I hate lima beans, but they're not evil. I hate crumbs and spills. They aren't evil, nor are the ones who created the crumbs and spills. And good cannot be defined by what I love. Good means that which is morally right or righteous. I love certain television programs, but are they good? Not according to this definition. I also love candy. Candy is tasty, but candy isn't morally right or righteous. Good and evil do not change with the times or with culture's shifting attitudes. A thing remains constantly either good or bad. And over time, we have begun to call things which were traditionally good, evil. We have begun to call things which were traditionally evil, good. If it is true that a thing remains good or bad, what has changed? We have. We changed. There's a piece of art that has won a lot of awards, and I cannot repeat the name of this artwork in the sanctuary for fear that God would strike me with lightning. There's this artist by the name of Andres Serrano, and he's photographed a picture of a small crucifix submerged in a glass of his own urine. In art shows all over the world, it is being hailed as brilliant, cutting edge. Not too long ago, people would have called that thing sacrilegious. 20 years ago, the artist would have been ridden out of town on a rail, but today he's considered to be an artistic genius. This blasphemous photo is just as evil today as it would have been years ago. Has goodness changed through the years? No, we have. The reason for this change is we have come to believe that good and evil is in the eye of the beholder. Good and evil are not subjective issues. The definition of what is good and what is evil comes out of God's dictionary, not ours. If there were no God, then that would be a different story. We could decide for ourselves what is good and what is evil. But there is a God, and he gets to say what is good and what is bad. Goodness has its foundation in God. Right is right, and wrong is wrong. There is a God above, and his objective standard is the standard of righteousness all around the world. There isn't one standard for the King of England and one for the newborn baby just born at St. Anthony's. God's standard is for all of us. When a culture will not acknowledge the evil in it, it gives way to barbarism, where anything can and will be justified. When there is no acknowledgement of evil, laws become irrelevant, and we are seeing that today. What you do is your own business and nobody else's. What someone else does is certainly not going to be any of your business. Think of the implications of that. It's a country on the verge of anarchy, and that is where we find ourselves today. But we do not have to live in this miserable condition. God does not leave us hanging. We can do something about it, and it has to begin with the self. Colossians 3, 5 through 10 tells us exactly what to do. Put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature, sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires, and greed, which is idolatry. Because of these, the wrath of God is coming. You used to walk in these ways in the life you once lived, but now you must rid yourselves of all such things as these: anger, rage, malice, slander, and filthy language from your lips. Do not lie to each other, since you have taken off your old self with its practices and have put on the new self, which is being renewed in the knowledge in the image of its creator. It isn't good enough to just get rid of the evil in our lives. The Apostle Paul tells us we have to put it to death. Abraham wasn't about to put up with evil, and I think we should take a lesson from good old Uncle Abraham. I'm not saying we should lead evil people to tar pits and make them jump in. What I am saying is we have to eradicate evil first within ourselves. I am also saying when evil rears its ugly head in our presence, we need to stand up against it. I have a friend who has been standing up against evil all winter long, and I'm really proud of her because it's been tough. It's been really hard. But I'm also proud to say, because she stood up to evil, she has rescued some vulnerable innocents from danger and more injury. Was it fun? No. Did she get blowback? Yes. Will she still get blowback? Yes. Has she lost family and friends over it? Yes. But that's not the point. Getting rid of evil pleases God and saves vulnerable and innocent people. And that is the point.